Hi, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Investec telephone conference on the coronavirus. My name's Philip Shaw. I look after the economics team here at Investec in London. We're very fortunate to have with us this morning Professor Michael Barrett, who is Professor of Biochemical Parasitology at the Institute of Infection, Immunity and Inflammation at Glasgow University. Michael is an expert in his field. The format of the call will be that I'll hand over to Michael in a second or two, who will speak about the virus itself and where we might be going. I'll then take over and give some thoughts about financial markets and the global economy. And the third part will be questions and answers, and I'm sure you've got plenty you'd like to ask. As an economist, I always look towards our forecasts and hope we get them right, but having spoken to Mike last week, I was hoping that he'd got something really wrong when he said that although the virus seemed to be contained within China, the major threat was a spread of the virus elsewhere in East Asia, and that seems to have happened. So, having put the pressure on you, Mike, I'll hand over to you.
Well, thanks, Phil. Good morning, everybody. So what I'll do is I'll just give a brief overview of the virus and the disease as we see it happening today, and then we'll probably try to maximise the amount of time that we have available for questions, because I think that probably that's where most value is going to come from. As Phil said, we spoke last week about where the disease was going, and we've watched this disease grow out of China, where the first case was documented on the 31st of December last year. The authorities were immediately concerned because the atypical pneumonia that was associated with the disease was very similar to the SARS outbreak of 2002-2003. Incredibly, within 9 days, the Chinese authorities had identified the virus that was responsible, and sure enough, it was very similar to the SARS virus of that earlier outbreak. This then led to extraordinary measures within China. I think everybody must have been following the news. We've seen that Wuhan was closed down. We've seen that many other cities have been closed down. And the Chinese have got some kind of handle on the disease, although I think we still need to be nervous as to what happens when a situation arises where you have to release those lockdowns. More concerning, I think, has been the relatively rapid spread of the disease now in South Korea, Singapore. Japan has cases, and then amazingly last Thursday we saw a few cases appear in Italy, and then by Monday morning we had over 200 cases. I find that particularly perturbing because Italy has a pretty advanced health system, and yet it must be the case that many people went undiagnosed, unidentified as carrying the disease throughout last week before those first cases appeared. And we can be pretty certain that many people must have left their original cities and gone to other parts of Italy, other parts of Europe too. I think this morning there's been a case identified in a hotel in Tenerife, which I think is terrifying, because I believe a lot of people from that hotel in Tenerife have already left, got back to their countries of origin, including the UK. So I strongly suspect that there is coronavirus in the UK as we speak. Why has this epidemic spread so much more quickly and widely than that original SARS epidemic of 2002-2003? Well, I think the answer there relates to the virus being slightly different. With the original SARS epidemic, that virus replicated primarily in the deep part of the respiratory system. That meant that people became very ill very quickly and very identifiably, and it was relatively easy to isolate and contain those cases, which meant that we were able, ultimately, within the best part of a year, to bring that disease under control. We haven't seen that SARS virus since 2004. This virus also replicates down in the deep part of the respiratory system, and that's where the disease comes from. People who die will die of pneumonia. It seems that this virus can also replicate more readily than the previous one in the upper respiratory tract, a bit like a common cold. And what that means is that it's much easier to transmit. What's more, this virus appears to be able to transmit before people show symptoms. So effectively, you'll have somebody who's infected, doesn't know they're infected, walking around, breathing, sneezing, and the virus will be transmitted, and then the next generation of people who get the virus will do the same. That is why it has spread, and it makes it very, very difficult for us to contain the disease and stop the spread. Effectively, what we can do, and what we're still trying to do, is to capture the cases as we see them. And when we do see those cases, we try to get people isolated as quickly as possible. I think we need to have a public health campaign where everybody becomes aware that they need to self-isolate as soon as they suspect they may have symptoms of the disease and have a credible chance of having caught it, either having traveled to a place where the disease has become epidemic or having been in contact with somebody who has either been from one of those regions or has themselves had the disease. So I think that we're going to have to see a policy of encouraging as many people as possible to self-isolate. I think that we are going to see a situation in which different mass gatherings of people are going to be banned. Football matches, for example, church services. We've seen in South Korea that church services seem to have been fundamentally important in spreading the disease there. So isolation is really, I think, pretty much all we've got at the moment in order to help to contain the spread of this disease. In terms of treatments, we don't have any drugs which are active against the coronavirus. The Chinese have been running a whole series of clinical trials. We do have other antiviral drugs, and therefore there's been a great deal of optimism that we might be able to repurpose those for this specific virus. So far, they haven't looked terribly good. The only one I know of that's still causing some cause for excitement is remdesivir, which is undergoing trials in China as we speak and hasn't yet been dismissed from those trials. Vaccines, I don't think we're going to have one for the duration of this outbreak. We are seeing some fast-track vaccines going through the process in different biotech companies, but the fact is that without a vaccine that's already ready to go, by the time we've tested its ability to work, gone through a manufacture process to produce another vaccine to get into people for real clinical trials, I think we're going to be seeing the end of this epidemic stroke pandemic by the time we're in a position to really test for those cases. So really we are in a difficult situation. We are not able to treat this virus with any drugs. We're not able to vaccinate. So really we're using very ancient methodologies of quarantine, isolation to try to help to stop the spread of the disease. Perhaps on a rather pessimistic note, but I would stress that we don't know enough about the disease to really offer figures beyond a back of an envelope calculation, but some very good epidemiological modellers at Imperial College have estimated, based on their knowledge of this virus and its similarities to other viruses, that up to 60% of the UK's population could become infected in the first year once that virus starts transmitting. We don't think that everybody gets serious disease, probably 90%, we don't know the actual numbers, but around 90% may only get very mild or no disease at all, but that would still leave us with 6% of the population here in the next year getting a serious disease. That's 4 million people. The current fatality rate is around 2% or so, we think, and what that would mean is that we may see 80,000 deaths from coronavirus in the UK in the next year. It needn't be that bad. It could be that the isolation methods work. It could be, as some people hope, that once the sun comes out, ultraviolet light can help to curtail the spread of the virus. And other measures may enable us to keep those numbers lower than that. And again, to put things into context, there are around 500,000 deaths from all causes in the UK this year. 80,000 on top of that is significant, but it's not an Armageddon. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Mike. I'll now respond with some comments on financial markets and you know, where we think the global economy might go looking forward. And I think yesterday was a little bit of a groundbreaking day in global markets, and it seemed to be the session where investors suddenly decided that leaving interest rates lower for longer, or you know, perhaps looser fiscal policy, wasn't sufficient to offset the potential effects of COVID-19 as fears of a global pandemic began to surface. In terms of market levels, the FTSE 100 is now below pre-election levels, so it's basically wiped out the Boris bounce. And the S&P 500 index in the US is now negative on the year so far. You know, risk-off mood in markets has been accentuated. Looking at government bond markets, for example, you have 10-year US Treasury yields at 1.37%, and that's very close to an all-time low. So we've tried to make some sense out of all of this. I'm not quite sure how far we've got, to be honest, but the starting point for our comparison, as it has been with what Michael's just said, is the SARS epidemic, particularly in 2003. And it's pretty clear that COVID-19 is more infectious but less lethal. In terms of the impact of the economy, and I've said this several times, people still look at death rates and infection rates as the important metric for the economy. In an indirect sense, that's right, but directly, it's the containment measures which are going to cause the turbulence in the economic numbers. So, for example, 11 million people shut off in Wuhan. What we're trying to look at is the severity and the longevity of the containment measures. And obviously, they will be driven by the authorities' perceptions of infection rates. It does look as if the infection rate in China, at least, is tailing off sharply. Some of the containment measures have been eased in China. And what we've tried to do is to put some numbers to all this, at least on the basis that we don't get a global pandemic. And if you go back to 2003, look at the GDP profile in China, what you saw was growth falling away in the second quarter of 2003. And in the third quarter, once the worst of the epidemic had been contained, economic growth recovered about half of the lost output the following quarter. Now, in terms of what's likely to happen this time, it's really difficult from our points of view to believe that the Chinese economy won't contract over the first quarter, at least on a quarter-on-quarter basis, given the amount of disruption. And if you look at the anecdotal evidence, you know, you've got the pictures of the ghost towns around China over much of the past few weeks, the news from companies and the anecdotal news of shutdowns. You know, if you look at car sales, I think in the first 16 days within China, they were 92% down on a year ago. So we've penciled in something like a 0.5% decline in Chinese GDP, again, quarter on quarter, not year on year. And then on the assumption that the worst is over, you get some sort of catch up in the second quarter as the destocking process is reversed and other order backlogs are made up. And subsequently, after that, you get a return to trend in the Chinese economy, which is probably a little bit less than 1.5% on the quarter. And then we can, you know, if that happens, then we can start looking at deleveraging in China, phase two US trade agreements, and the things that we're quite used to in assessing the Chinese economy. What happens elsewhere? Well, clearly, we've made some assumptions on China's made trading partners. For example, East Asia, Australia and Germany. And what we think, and we're still working out our numbers now, we're planning to publish a little bit later in the week, but we reckon that Chinese GDP growth will be down below 5%, you know, possibly 4.7-4.8%, and the rumoured target for Beijing for GDP growth was 6% for this year, and it seems very unlikely that, number one, that will be reached, and number two, that the Chinese authorities will set that target. In terms of global growth, factoring in everything together on a separate envelope from Mike's calculations that he was talking about earlier, possibly something like a 0.5% hit to global growth this year, so 2.8% global growth, And that's actually a touch lower than last year's 2.9%. Now, you know, we've tried to throw some numbers together on what happens if we get a global pandemic from COVID-19. You can almost choose your numbers, but illustratively, you could get global growth at 1.9% and below 2%. And there is no official definition of what constitutes a global economic recession, but a lot of people will say anything below 2% is precisely that. Several points, I guess, arising from that. There still seems to be some pretty optimistic views out there about the hits to the world economy. So, for example, the IMF at the G20 meeting at Riyadh over the weekend suggested that it would be shaving 0.1 percentage points off global growth. I mean, really, that looks too optimistic from our perspectives. We know that global supply chains are already being hit. We had comments from Associated British Foods yesterday on a number of fronts, but including Primark. There have been reports of Jaguar Land Rover bringing in parts for their vehicles in suitcases back from Beijing whilst they're allowed out of the country. And in particular, if you look one of the best survey sets around, the Purchasing Managers Indices or the PMIs, even the one for the UK was reporting that supply chains were being hit already. And when you take into account that most supplies are shipped rather than air freighted, and it takes probably about 35 to 40 days to ship from mainland China to the UK, I think you've got to expect more news on that front. In terms of what the authorities are doing, stimulus, we've had a 10 basis point cut in the Chinese main rate, the one-year loan prime rate. The People's Bank of China is hinting at more stimulus to come. You may get Beijing easing fiscal policy. Even last night, we had Donald Trump asking Congress for $2.5 billion of funds to fight the effects of the virus. In terms of other areas, we are already looking at the European Central Bank and the Reserve Bank of Australia, perhaps also the Fed cutting rates again at some point this year. And the downside risk, I think, to the global economy reinforced that baseline view. And here in the UK, if you're cynical, you could argue that what's happening with COVID-19 could be used as a justification for the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, to loosen the fiscal rules or the proposed fiscal rules in the budget here, which takes place on the 11th of March. So there's lots of things here that we could talk about. Just wrapping up with a couple of comments. We haven't had any firm Chinese economic data yet, but note that we get the PMIs for February at the weekend, although, you know, one of the sets of PMIs from China is official. They're compiled by Beijing. And that's a good point with the Chinese economic numbers. Can we be confident that their National Bureau of Statistics is going to be publishing an accurate set of economic data when it comes to be publishing the numbers for the first quarter, for example, on GDP, which will be coming out in April? The evidence outside China is really mixed. Even the surveys we place some weight on are very different in what they're suggesting for the economy. So, for example, in the US, we had the US Empire State and the Philly Fed surveys very strong last week. And yes, at the end of the week, we had the US PMIs, the preliminary or the flash numbers, at their weakest since 2013. So it's very difficult to disentangle exactly what's going on. And the final comment, I guess, before I hand over to Q&A, is that if you get a lasting impact here, countries may be very tempted to resupply onshore, and that could be another step in the reversal of the globalisation, which we've seen from the tariff wars over the last couple of years or so. So that's all I have to say at the moment. If I could hand back over to Kevin, who will ask for questions and answers.
Our first question comes from Paul Thomas from Net Consulting Limited. Please go ahead.
Hi there. I was just as an employer, I just wanted to understand what we should look out for in terms of early warning signs with employees.
The very early warning signs, we don't have them. I think you probably need to get, at the moment still, a very thorough travel history make sure that anybody who has been to China, for example, but Singapore, Japan, and now certainly Northern Italy, we're going to have to keep an eye as to where other places are. I would strongly suggest that anybody who's been to a place where the epidemic is still active, I would even think about asking that person to take a fortnight off work, check their own temperature at home, and call 111 if they do feel any suspicion that they may have the infection, which would manifest as a cough, temperature, shortness of breath. But really, we don't, that's the problem. We don't, we go through this asymptomatic period where people can carry the virus. We don't know they've got it. So really, all we can do at the moment is to get a thorough travel history and contact history and recommend that people self-isolate if they're coming from somewhere which is potentially risky.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next question comes from the line of Richard Allen. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Isn't there a less alarmist scenario that suggests that whilst containment probably fails and the virus takes its course, the rate of infection will peter out over the summer and a vaccine will be available by towards the end of the summer? So we simply don't see the impact either from containment or from a pandemic effect.
Thanks, Richard. Yes, I think that we... I think we can grab hold of some aspects, and certainly we know that with the flu virus, the summer is good. The ultraviolet light, for example, will destroy viruses in a way which we don't see them destroyed in the winter. I'm not confident that we're going to have a vaccine by the end of this summer. It's just that at the moment we haven't really tested the efficacy of any of the vaccines which are being proposed. This will take time. There'll be some failures, so I don't see that we're going to have a vaccine ready for at least 1 year, perhaps longer. But certainly, I think, you know, I apologise for being alarmist. I've just done those back of the envelope calculations, and that's where I came. But I think we can certainly hope that there may be some interventions which are going to lead to a less problematic scenario than that one I did put forward.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Dave Murray. Please go ahead.
Professor Barrett, a quick question for you. What with this type of virus, what is the risk of mutation, which clearly might result in different infection and mortality rates?
It's high. RNA viruses are prone to infection. Mutation. Just because of the nature of their replication. So we are a little concerned that we could see a mutation. There have been some suggestions that in Iran there is a much higher fatality rate than elsewhere, and the doomsayers see that as evidence of a mutation which has gone more virulent. I personally suspect that the Iran situation at the moment is that the Iranian authorities aren't actually reporting the full scale of the epidemic and the numbers of people infected, whereas the deaths are easier to see. So I don't think we've necessarily got a mutation in Iran, but there is a risk, and we have to keep an eye out for that risk. There is also a possibility that a mutation could make the virus less virulent if the virus transmits even better when it's less virulent and doesn't run out of patients to infect so quickly. That could be evolutionarily advantageous, so we also cannot rule out that we would get mutations which make the virus less virulent.
Great, thanks.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Jens Lindquist. Please go ahead.
Just curious, really, is there any evidence of a continued or repeat transmission from the animal pool? Bats have been mentioned. To humans, and if so, does that complicate in any way the containment effort?
Thanks, Jens. So far, no. The genetic evidence, so people are sequencing the virus as it's turning up in different places, the evidence so far is entirely consistent with it having come from the index case, the first individual who was infected. we cannot rule out that a bat or another wild animal could continue to transmit, but I think at the moment all of the evidence is that that's not the case, and we're really following a virus which entered the human population just one time in Wuhan, and that is the same virus which is now turning up all around the world.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Stephen White. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Just in the scenario where the virus continues to take hold in Europe, what do you think could be the potential impacts on, say, tourism in London, for example?
Phil?
Yeah, I guess that could be one for me. Yeah, I think as we've already heard from Michael that you're going to get more containment measures and trying to prevent crowds from congregating in one place. It looks as though the number of in particular Chinese tourists has come down sharply already. I think if we're looking at Europe more widely, what has been suggested by Austria is that they close their borders, and particularly because of the threat of infection coming from Italy. And although EU countries and some others are Schengen countries, where you've got the freedom of movement across borders without checks, it is entirely legitimate for those countries to close their borders, and that's entirely in line with EU law. And in fact, this is quite a common thing with counter-terrorism proposals. So I think everywhere there is going to be, if it looks like we're in a global pandemic, there's going to be much more containment, and specifically you'll have much more checks at borders, and I don't know, possibly testing if that's feasible, but you will get a closing down of those Schengen borders to try and contain the virus within national boundaries as well, within continental Europe.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Megameno Shetanyenga. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. Thanks for the conference. I just want to ask something with regard to, there have been very few cases in Africa. Is it more a testing issue or capability or really the weather advantage? And what sort of testing equipment are being used for this virus?
Thank you. It's true, and apart from some cases in Egypt, we haven't seen any cases in sub-Saharan Africa, and we don't know why. It's fantastic news that we haven't, because the fear is that if it does reach parts of sub-Saharan Africa, it's going to rip through populations with very under-resourced health systems. Is it the climate that's been protecting us? We don't know. There's a lot of Chinese movement in different parts of Africa, so I think we have to be happy at the moment that sub-Saharan Africa hasn't been hit. Some people have suggested it's really just a problem of diagnosis. There are many people in parts of Africa who have all sorts of febrile fever related illnesses like malaria. Are we seeing misdiagnosis? Possibly. At the moment, the way that we diagnose the disease to get a positive diagnosis uses sophisticated technology that we call real-time PCR to look for the virus's genome, and the kits and machinery to do that isn't available in many places in sub-Saharan Africa. Nevertheless, I don't think we're seeing it in sub-Saharan Africa, because I think with our global connectivity and social media, we would be seeing a lot of messages coming out of Africa of suspect cases, and we're not really seeing that. So until now, the good news is that the virus hasn't hit sub-Saharan Africa, and I think we just have to hope it stays that way.
Thank you. We do have a further question on the phone lines. The next question comes from the line of Jason Atkinson. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi, good morning. I'm on the board of a global recruitment network, and we have a global conference every year, and we have our conference in Singapore this year, 18th of May. about 100 delegates, mostly coming from Europe. We spent a lot of time planning it. It's sort of our mini Olympic Games. And we have a weekly call now to discuss the virus. And, you know, I'm just sort of a stakeholder, but the chairman is adamant that it's going ahead. And I just wondered if there's any input as to sort of where we might go for sources of help, you know, to help us make a decision now or, you know, soon, whether to pull the plug on it. If there's anything you can help with, that would be appreciated.
Difficult to make a call on that one. Actually, if you look at Singapore, the increase in incidence has slowed significantly in recent days, and it is possible because actually Singapore does have a highly sophisticated health system and is a highly contained, smallish economy. It could be that Singapore will get a handle on this in the next few weeks. I think my advice would be to keep your conference open for now, but keep looking at the cases in Singapore and make a judgment call as to whether they look as if they're going up or as if they really have stabilised. In terms of where you can go for advice on this, WHO is the best place to get advice on anything health related. But I'm personally not sure as to whether there's a sort of place within WHO that you can go to ask for specific advice of this nature. But just keep looking at those numbers in Singapore. And if they are going up and appear to be continually going up, I would think very hard about not going to Singapore. But if they stabilise even on their way down, then I think go ahead with the meeting.
Okay, thank you for that.
Our next question comes from Sally Hoyle. Please go ahead.
Good morning. I just wanted to ask, it seems like there are cases or patients who test with those DNA tests, the first test negative and then came back positive, or even some sort of like a clinically recovered and patients later they test positive again. So my question would be, how reliable are those test kits, and also are all the countries are using the same test kit?
The answer is actually the test kits are coming from different manufacturers, but the kits are very well controlled because you're only doing diagnostic tests within accredited diagnostic laboratories, and they're always done with relevant controls to make sure that the kits which are being used are working. So the tests are quite difficult. The viral genome is made of RNA. RNA is actually a rather labile material, so the speed with which one gets the samples to the diagnostic centre is quite important. I think another issue is where patients may first test negative and later test positive can be related to the fact that they may be harbouring sub-detectable levels of virus, which you will not pick up on the first test, but then if you go back and get a sputum sample a day or two later, they may actually have gone over the threshold where it becomes detectable. So the test isn't perfect, but the test centres are very, very well controlled. So I think that we can be fairly certain that the actual tests themselves are working within those centres, but there can be other reasons why the diagnostic tests are unreliable.
Okay, thank you very much everybody for attending this teleconference, and of course a special thank you to Mike, whose insights I think have been absolutely fascinating, and hopefully they'll give us a little bit of a steer on how to deal with potential effects of COVID-19 going forward. So thank you very much and have a good day.